Tonight's topic, homosexuality. The first thing I want to do in covering this topic is to look at our terminology that we use, because there's obviously a lot of terms out there. And the phrase that the church will use, and I'm going to get into in a little bit why, but the phrase that the church uses is same-sex attraction, and is just often abbreviated SSA, same-sex attraction. And the real reason why we talk about this is we don't like to use the word, not that it's a bad word, although certainly some people consider it bad or derogatory, but we don't like to use the word gay or lesbian because it's kind of been claimed by the so-called gay culture. And one of the problems that the church has with the gay culture is that it seems to be wanting to make sexual orientation so central to a person's identity, so that like the first thing that you need to know about this person is that they're gay. And I don't know if you've noticed this, but you know, I would bet, I don't want to show of hands, but I would bet probably all of us here either has a family or friend who has SSA or knows someone, or you know, I mean, so my point is it's touched probably everyone here to a degree, and I don't want to paint with broad strokes and suggest that everyone in that so-called gay culture is pushing this, but you will notice that often, that it seems to be so central to their identity, as if it's the first thing they're going to tell you. Like, what's most important about me is that I'm gay. Well, no, the most important thing about you is that you're a human being who's been created in the image and likeness of God. You know, and there are so many other characteristics that you could use to describe yourself before you even get into your sexual orientation. You know, you're a child of God. Well, okay, then you're male or female. And, you know, how old you are, what race you are, what you do for a living, where you live, where you're from, what language you speak, you know. And the idea that one would first and foremost identify themselves by their sexual orientation is just kind of weird. And it says something about, and again, this is not the entire gay culture, but it's pretty rampant in it, that people in that culture, that becomes the main thing about them, that they're gay. And I understand some people have tried to counter this argument, well, you know, when you're in the minority, that has to be the thing about you. And they'll point to something like slavery and say, well, before the abolition of slavery, you know, it was important for African Americans to identify themselves, not that they would need to, I mean, obviously they could, but I mean, for them to stick together in that crowd because they were in the minority. I don't think this really works. I don't think the analogy really fits the same because this is something that spans in terms of a phenomenon, in terms of people having SSA, it spans all sexes, races, peoples, cultures, times, everything, you know. So that's the first thing. That's the real reason why we don't even like to use that terminology. And that's even why when someone comes to me, for instance, either in confession or for advice or whatever, and says, Father, I'm gay, I say, well, no, you're not gay. And especially if they're, like, younger, it's like, well, number one, you know, you're at that age where, you know, all sorts of different things are going on hormonally and in terms of maturation and, you know, because you have certain feelings or you've done certain things on a whim, that doesn't necessarily mean that that's your sexual orientation. But even someone who is older and who says, Father, this is the type of sexual orientation I've experienced for 40, 50 years, and I've always had it, and I'm sure I always will have it. Well, fine, that still doesn't make you gay. That makes you a human being who happens to have a same-sex attraction. I mean, and again, it's not central to you, nor should it be. So that's the first thing. And you'll hear, too, you know, even with, in the so-called gay culture, even references to like alternative lifestyle, you know, these different terms that are used and what it all comes down to. Or, for instance, if I could pick on the Human Rights Campaign, okay, that's what they call themselves, but all they do is advocate for, you know, rights, which aren't even really rights, of people with SSA. And again, are you advocating human rights, or are you advocating so-called rights for this particular group of people who has this particular disorder? If you're really human rights campaigning, you would be advocating for human rights, period, you know, for the unborn first and foremost, and then going on from there. So that's the little rant on terminology. And as I said just a minute ago, as a disorder, that's what I want to talk about. What is SSA? Well, objectively speaking, it is a disorder. And let me unpack that, because sometimes people get very touchy when they hear that word in reference to SSA. But objectively speaking, it is a disorder. And what the church means by that is that it is something that shouldn't be this way. That sexual orientation, that one sexual orientation is supposed to be heterosexual, and this particular person happens to be homosexual, and that is a disorder. It is not how it should be. And please understand that when we use that term disorder, that doesn't tie into it yet any kind of morality or anything. We're not blaming the person. We're not saying this is your fault. We're saying it is a disorder. And sometimes we have to approach this very carefully. And let's give some other examples. There are disorders all over creation, all over the world. There are people born with all sorts of deformities, people born with all sorts of genetic things, people born with all sorts of other things, and not just people born, but people who develop things later on. You know, there is a sense in which there is, you know, we look at nature and we see how things are supposed to be, and when things are not that way, it is, objectively speaking, a disorder. Again, we haven't attached blame to anything there. We're just saying it's not the way it should be. You are supposed to be attracted to people of the other sex, and if you're not, that is a disorder. You are supposed to be able to see, and if you can't, that's a disorder. Again, however you got blind, that's not your fault. But it's a disorder, you know, and we could go through all of that. I mean, you're supposed to be able to do certain things and have certain senses and abilities and whatever, and to not have that is a disorder in the technical sense of the word. It is objectively disordered. And that's what the church teaches about SSA, that it is objectively disordered. And again, this does not depend on how one gets it. There's, of course, this debate in this topic of nature versus nurture. You know, well, what is it? Is it something that develops through nurturing the child in a certain way? Or is it in their nature? Is it something that they were born with? Or not just born with, is it something they were conceived with? Is it in their genes to have become gay, you know? And I've been talking to a few different people in preparation for this meeting, and one of the things that, you know, we kept bringing up was, regardless of how one gets this disorder, it's still a disorder. And regardless of how one gets it, it's still always going to be objectively wrong to act on it. And we're going to get into that too in a minute here. But the reason I bring this up is because, especially nowadays, there seems to be this big push in the gay culture to try to get it recognized as something that people are born with, as if that makes a difference. And the point I'm trying to make is it doesn't make a difference. Even if you had every single scientist on the face of this earth to all agree, and through, you know, all following all the rules of experimentation and everything, and they were all to agree that, you know, solid science, this is something genetic, we've been able to prove it beyond a shadow of a doubt, even if that were ever one day to happen, and personally I don't think that ever will, and the way the science looks nowadays, it looks like that's not the case. But what I tell people is, even if we could one day prove that it is not just something you're born with, but even something maybe you were conceived with, that it's genetic, that wouldn't affect the validity of the church teaching one iota. Because people want to say, well, then their argument goes along this way, well, if I was conceived with it, then somehow, then that means that God made me that way, because God doesn't make mistakes, right? And so if it's in my very genes, then God made me this way, and God makes perfectly, and that means I'm perfect, and that means there's nothing wrong with it. And the problem with this logic is, again, when we look around creation, we see all sorts of things that aren't the way they should be. We see disorder all throughout creation, and that's part of being in a fallen creation. That's, you know, when the angels disobeyed and when the humans disobeyed, and as I preached on this a few weeks ago, sin affects the entire cosmos, the entire world order. And so when creation fell, and we talk about that, the fall of the angels, the fall of men, when creation fell, these kinds of, all sorts of things were thrown out of whack. And that's why you have, for instance, people who are born with all sorts of other things, not just in this psychological realm, because sometimes people want to say, well, you know, you can't make the same comparison because this is psychological and other things are physical or whatever. It doesn't matter. I mean, a physical deformity, a psychological deformity, a psychosexual deformity, whatever you want to call it, disorder, these kinds of things are in our fallen nature. Now, God does not want them there. God did not put them there. They are there because God gave us free will, us and the angels, and through our disobedience, through our sin, these things have kind of gone out of whack. And as I've preached before, God had to give us free will, because if he didn't give us free will, we couldn't freely choose to love him and one day get to heaven. If he had just made us like little robots that only ever could possibly physically do the right thing, well, that's no merit to us, and we wouldn't wind up in heaven. So he gave us free will, because if he didn't give us free will, we could never wind up in heaven. But he also knew that in giving us free will, there would be the possibility that we could also then turn against him and introduce sin and corruption into the world. And we see its effects to this day. The fact that things happen that shouldn't happen. And again, people want to kind of blame God and say, well, if God's God, he certainly can prevent it, because God can do anything, right? And if he loves us, why wouldn't he prevent it? And again, that logic is flawed as well, because we say, well, in order for God to fix this, he would have to revoke the free will that got us in this mess. And again, he's not going to do that, number one, because he's already given it to us, but he wants us to be able to get to heaven, and that free will is a condition of us being able to get to heaven, without which we wouldn't be able to get to heaven. So that's the problem here. That's why we see in creation all sorts of other things that are objectively disordered. They are a certain way, and they shouldn't be. Now again, God does not like that. God did not want that. God did not do that. We were the ones who screwed it up. We, human beings and angels. We who had free will. But there was a gospel that I preached on a few weeks ago with the healing of the man born blind. And as I preached, the point I tried making was because the disciples asked the Lord, you know, whose fault was this? Was it his fault or was it his parents' fault that he was born blind? And the Lord answered, says it was no one's fault. Not to say no one's fault in the sense of, you know, no one's fault, but he's saying it wasn't his fault, it wasn't his parents' fault, it's your fault. It's the fault of sin in this world. We all contribute to it. But then he kind of answers the question that they should have asked with, what are you going to do about it? And this is where we can talk about God, although not wanting these disorders, although not liking them, he allows them, again, because to not allow them would be to revoke our free will, but he also allows them because he can and will, is planning on, and is going to, pull a greater good out of this. And again, that doesn't mean that God likes seeing people suffer. Sometimes people have that idea that, well, you know, God likes, you know, God wanted to pull this greater good out, but it required that I suffer. No, God would have preferred that you not suffer. But despite the suffering, God is still going to pull a greater good out of it. And sometimes that greater good is something we never see in this life. Sometimes it is, but sometimes it's not. For instance, that man born blind, the greater good was the coming to faith of all of those other people who witnessed that healing. But there are other times where the Lord doesn't heal, not because he wants to see the person continue to suffer with whatever affliction they have, blindness or SSA or whatever, but because he's saying, you know what, the greater good that I'm going to pull out of this is going to come through your continuing to bear it as a cross. And I preached on this on Good Friday. I talked about embracing our own crosses. And by the way, both of those homilies that I just mentioned here are on my website. I was going to mention that too in the beginning as well. People asked me about the first two talks, putting them on the website. I tried putting them on the website, but with them being a half hour of me talking and then 45 minutes of questions, it was like a really big file. And even when I tried breaking it up, it was still pretty big files. So they're not on the website. I'm still working on that, but my homilies are, and I just updated the website last week. So a lot of my homilies, the Good Friday one, the one of the man born blind, those are on the website, and that's rudapriest.com. So you take my last name and you chop off the M-A-N-N, rudaman, and you put priest. So R-E-U-T-E, priest.com, one word, rudapriest.com. So listen to the homilies if you want. Again, it's an objective disorder, and however one gets it does not change the church teaching. And, you know, especially like in pop culture, for instance, this is seen so often now in the gay culture of wanting to push that it is something you're born with. I mean, hello, this new song Lady Gaga put out, Born This Way, you know. Now, it's not explicitly in defense of the gay culture, but there are many, many very clear references. It's a good song. I mean, it's kind of catchy and whatnot, but you know, I mean, maybe you don't know, but I mean, she does a lot of advocacy for that particular community, that particular group of people, and you have to wonder, like, what's the point here? You're trying to suggest this same old, tired, fallacious argument that somehow, if I was born this way, that means that God made me this way, that God wants me this way, because God's perfect and God doesn't make mistakes, right? And therefore, I should be allowed to live this way, because I was born this way. Well, okay, people are born with two heads. People are born without limbs. People are born with, you know, with all sorts of other psychological... People are born sometimes addicted to crack, or born addicted to alcohol. Does that mean God likes that or wants that, or is giving you license to live that way? So that's that. Now, the teaching of the church, and okay, let me say one other thing about the objective disorder. People will say, well, who says it's objective? You know, how is this disordered on an objective level? And what the church always says to that is, look at nature. Look at nature. If you don't need to be a rocket scientist to look at the male body and the female body and see that there is a certain natural complementarity to those two bodies, that when they come together in a certain way, that something can happen, namely procreation of a child, that cannot happen when two men or two women come together. So when the church preaches against, homosexual acts, and this is another distinction we'll get into in a minute between simply having an orientation versus acting on it, people say, oh, well, that's fine if you guys want to believe that as Catholics, but why impose that on the rest of us? Well, because it's found in nature. Yes, it is backed up in Scripture. Scripture does preach against it, but it really doesn't even need to, because nature is normative. Thomas Aquinas made that point, that when you see something in nature, that is normative. The fact that there is that natural complementarity between the male and female body, that when they come together in this special way, that this great thing called procreation can happen, that can't happen anywhere else, that says something normative for us. That sets a norm for us. So we don't even have to appeal to Scripture. Yes, you can. You can point out certain places in Scripture where homosexual acts are condemned. But my point is, again, on an apologetics level, you don't even need to, because some people don't subscribe to that, but everyone has to subscribe to nature. I mean, you're an idiot. You're against science. You're against reason to disagree with nature. You know, it's in vogue to disagree with Scripture and the Church, but you know, you can't disagree with nature. So the Church teaching. The first thing the Church teaches, and this is kind of the last section here. The first thing the Church teaches, of course, is that those who find themselves with SSA are 100% absolutely to be treated with the utmost dignity and respect and compassion, and to be treated as the children of God that they are. Because again, what is central to their being is not a disordered sexual orientation. Just as someone who's blind, what is central to their identity is not that they're blind, or that they have one arm, or that they're addicted to crack. They're a human being who is created in the image and likeness of God. And so the church has again and again and again not just preached this, but gone as far as to condemn persecution and attacks against those with this condition. And that's something that we should remember, that the church teaches very clearly against that. And again, the other thing here is that we do make this distinction between simply having this disordered sexual orientation versus acting on it. And we're going to get into that in a minute here, that distinction. The next part of the church teaching is that all of us are called to chastity, right? Chastity means different things for different people. As a priest who's taken a vow of, you know, celibacy, chastity means celibacy for me. Chastity for a married couple means, you know, proper sexual relations just between them and to the exclusion of anyone else. Chastity for a single person means, yeah, you can date, but you're going to keep appropriate boundaries and you're going to reserve sex for marriage. So we're all called to chastity, and that's an important point. And that includes those who find themselves with this disordered sexual orientation. They're still called to chastity. And the point to make about this, because sometimes people think, well, that's not fair because, you know, at least married people have this, you know, at least married people can have sex, and homosexual people can never have sex because they can't get married. And yes, that's true, but you're looking at it the wrong way. You're looking at it as if heterosexual people are allowed to just have as much sex as they want whenever they want. Or that married people are allowed to do that too. And certainly married people can't do that. That's why the church teaches against contraception, which is another topic we're going to cover in a future apologetics class, and teaches NFP, that even within marriage, you can't just, marriage cannot be just an outlet for the partners to derive sexual pleasure. And when marriages become that, that's when they begin to fall apart, of course. That when marriages become just, you know, the legitimate way of, you know, satisfying yourself, well, obviously it's going to fall apart, and they do. So that's the point I like to make, is that, you know, we're all called to chastity, and because sex is reserved for marriage, because, of course, the point of the sexual act is twofold. Pope Paul VI, excuse me, I'm good. Pope Paul VI, in his encyclical Humanae Vitae, in which he formally came out with a church teaching against contraception, he talked about sex having two dimensions. And he said that the procreative dimension and the unitive dimension, and that if sex does not have both of these dimensions, it's not really sex. It's not really what it's supposed to be. Both need to be present, and they need to be present simultaneously. Now, what that means, because people often think that the Catholic Church teaches that, you know, married couples can only have sex if they're planning on having a baby, which is also not true. But what that means when the Pope says that both of those dimensions need to be present simultaneously is why, for instance, even within marriage, you can't use contraception. Even within marriage, you're called to have that openness to children, that the unitive dimension needs to be present, at least not impeded, you know, and not just by a physical barrier, but even by a chemical barrier or any other way in which that's impeded. And the wonderful thing about natural family planning is that there is no barrier. It is completely, as per its name, natural. And the other interesting thing too is that if you use natural family planning properly, and a lot of the problems are people don't use it properly, but if you do use it properly, and yes, it does take some effort in charting your body and whatnot, but if you use it properly, it's actually more effective than all other forms of birth control combined, if you use it properly. And the other thing interesting too about natural family planning is that there are just as many couples using natural family planning who are trying to get pregnant who are having problems getting pregnant. There are just as many people using NFP trying to get pregnant than there are people who are using NFP because they don't want to get pregnant. That it can be so accurate in terms of giving you a 3 or 4 day window where they can tell you, you know, this is when to become pregnant. So when you use something like NFP, that unit of dimension is still there. The unit of dimension is not being impeded. But again, there's also the excuse me, the procreative dimension. There's also the unit of dimension of perhaps. So when we look at something like really weird, the homosexual act, sometimes they'll even try to argue, well, there is something unitive about that, that, you know, there is a certain type of love making, you know, we do grow closer to each other and, you know, all sorts of BS like that. And you say, well, even if that were true, which is not, but even if it were true, the procreative dimension is absent. And this is also why the church teaches against, just as an aside, against something like surrogacy or IVF, in vitro fertilization, even within marriage. Because people will say, well, wait a minute, the church is all about, you know, babies and pro-life and everything else, so what's wrong with that? Well, you're separating the two dimensions. You might have the unitive dimension because you're a married couple and you love each other and you're having sexual relations, but you've now separated the two dimensions because now the procreative dimension is being done later in a lab in a test tube by scientists. You know, you're separating the two dimensions, that they both need to be present and they both need to be present simultaneously. So that's why contraception doesn't work, because the procreative dimension is completely absent, and why NFP and IVF don't work because they're separated, and why homosexual acts don't work because the procreative dimension is absent entirely. So again, those two dimensions need to be there. And the other thing about everyone being called to chastity is there is a large number of people who find themselves with SSA who are trying to live that vocation to chastity, who are trying to be good, holy, faithful Catholic Christians, who find themselves with this particular disorder, who recognize it as such, and who are trying to live the good, holy life to which all of us are called. And they are done an awful disservice when, again, the gay culture seems to suggest that it's wrong not to act on this. Again, coming back to this idea that, well, you know, you should just be able to act on this. Again, are people with heterosexual orientation allowed to just act on that whenever they want? No, and when they do, that's called rape, you know, and they get thrown in jail. Or it's called cheating, and they get divorced. So heterosexual people can't just act on their orientation whenever they want either. So this idea that, well, you know, again, it's prevalent in the gay culture that, well, you should act on this, and it's kind of weird for you not to, as if you're repressing. Oh, you're being so repressive by, you know, not act as if you're just going to blow up if you don't have sex or implode if you don't have sex. And I want to tell people, like, I'm living proof. I'm celibate. I've been this way for a while. So there's that. And then the last part is that all of us are called, like I said, to holiness. All of us are called to love and to be loved. And sometimes people will look at the church teaching and say, oh, well, does this mean that homosexual people, the people with SSA, they're somehow excluded from ever experiencing love? No, that's also BS. They experience love and they experience being loved, but in a chaste way, in the same way that I, for instance, as a celibate priest, can both love people and be loved by people. You know, yes, sex is one type of love, but it's not the only type of love. And our Holy Father, Pope Benedict XVI, in his first encyclical as Pope, he put out that encyclical Deus Caritas Est, God is love. And he talked about the different types of love. You know, in English, we just have this one word, love. But he went into the Greek and talked about the four different types of love in the Greek, all of which we translate as just love. And erotic love being one of them, that's important and has its role, but only one type of love, you know. So yes, people with SSA are still called to love and to be loved, but again, in that chaste way. And they're still called to have friendships and you know, all of that other stuff. They cannot get married, and therefore they can't engage in sex. But sometimes they look at this as, I just can't have sex. Well, no, you can't have sex because you can't be married. And you can't be married, again, because look at nature. There can't be this union between male and male or female and female. So it's not that we're just telling you can't have sex. We're saying sex is a function of marriage and you can't get married. And again, that doesn't mean you can't love someone. It doesn't mean you can't be friends with someone. But marriage having that principal purpose of the procreation of children and the mutual enrichment and providing for of each other, the mutual, I don't know what the word I'm looking for, but that those are the two ends of marriage, you know, the mutual love and support of the partners and the procreation and rearing of children. And then just to that last point, and this is the last thing I'm going to say, is, you know, when it comes to homosexual unions, and especially now with these issues of adoption, you know, there is something abusive about that when you think about homosexual couples adopting. I think, I don't think it's a stretch at all to call that child abuse, because every child deserves to be raised in as ordered of a life as possible. Every child deserves to be raised in as ordered of a life as possible, meaning by a mother and a father who love each other and who are married, who are bound in the sacrament of matrimony. Every child deserves that. Now, practically, does it happen? No. And sometimes through no fault of one couple or the other. You know, one of the two partners dies, one of the two partners leaves the other, and you have a single mother left with kids. Now, is that her fault? No. But it's not ideal. I think anyone would acknowledge that it's not ideal. There are plenty of heroic men and women out there who are single parents, who, again, it's no fault of their own that they find themselves in this situation. But I think anyone would admit that it's still not ideal. You know, children deserve to be raised in as objectively ordered of a life as possible. To have a mommy and a daddy. To not have two moms or two dads. And just to think the kind of abuse, psychological abuse that can have, even with the most loving people. And again, I don't want to bash their intentions, because their intentions are certainly upright. They say, well, you know, better we raise these kids than they wind up in an orphanage or something. And I kind of look at something like that. My grandmother was orphaned at a very young age and raised in an orphanage by a bunch of nuns. And again, not an ideal situation, but the way she talks about this, I mean, it's you would think, you know, you think of like the movie Annie or something, like they're all these really depressed kind of, you know, kids or something. But again, it's not an ideal situation. But the way she'll talk about these nuns raising her and growing up and the love they had for them, but again, even that, there's still something that's not the way it should be. That children should have a mother and a father who love each other and who are joined in marriage. That's what kids deserve, and that's why the church speaks out against not just homosexual unions, but adoption as well. So that was it. That was the last point I had. And I'll take questions. The other thing just to keep in mind is in these books that I'll put out, they get into a little bit more detail with some of the causes of SSA, and it's written by a Catholic priest, Father Harvey, who has pretty much spent his entire priesthood dedicated to ministering to people with SSA, and he has all sorts of degrees in psychology and psychosexual development and all sorts of other things, and so he has a really interesting take on how it develops and hypothesized causes of it and all that kind of thing, so I would encourage you to pick that up. And with that, I'll take questions. I'm going to put these out on the side if you guys want to leave. So.